You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello there, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. Anybody who follows Curiosity Invited recognizes the face on the screen other than mine. That is Jeff Scoop. Hi, Jeff. Welcome back. Welcome
hey, great back. Great to be back, David. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for being here. I appreciate it. And maybe this is the best way to introduce the situation. The occasion for this appearance on Curiosity Invited is Jeff just published a memoir called American Nazi, From Hate to Humanity. Why would somebody call American Nazi? So Jeff's work for a big chunk of his life, he was the commander, which I think was the title, right? The commander, basically yep. the head honcho at the National Socialist Movement. And for those who do not know of the National Socialist Movement, it is the American Nazi Party. And since then, Jeff founded and is the executive director of Beyond Barriers, which is an organization that actually does the opposite of what he was doing for many years in the National Socialist Movement, which is to help people, to encourage people not to get into the hate and to help people get out. And the great thing from my point of view is that this book came out, which says a lot. And once again, that's American Nazi. Jeff, again, thank you for being here. And it occurred to me as I was both reading the book, which, by the way, I've not yet finished. I got to the part where you're like, post extreme. I'm not there yet. So I've been steeped in the negativity reading this book. And it got me thinking. It's like, I imagine it was a really hard thing to write. Hard because writing is, for at least for many people, certainly for me, is a hard thing. But also, a memoir. You're digging into a past that is filled with negativity, filled with violence, filled with hate. And that's had to be a wrestling match.
It was one of the hardest things I've done. I didn't expect, I knew it'd be difficult, but I did not expect it to be as difficult as it was. It took years actually to finish that book. And when I had gotten darkness, I guess is the best way I could explain it in one word. If you asked one word, obviously there's a redemptive arc, there's a happy ending on it, but there's a lot of darkness in there because it was a lot of years. I was involved 27 years total, 25, leading the organization and, processing through a lot of that stuff, especially those old memories. There was things that I assumed that I had processed when I had gotten out, during that, as we talked about before, like that decompression period, that first period after leaving. But when you start revisiting those old memories, painful old memories and things like that, it's trauma. It's a lot of trauma, And I didn't believe I had trauma until I really processed a lot of those things.
It's not even digging into the memories. Like it's recollecting in detail some of the, it's just miserable. It's miserable, which is not a big selling point, but there is a happy ending. But I actually was thinking about that as well. So here you are now, you left
2019.
So it's fresh. It's not that long ago that you were in the movement. And I recognize that it was a process, that a gradual process of feeling like you were wearing clothes that didn't fit. But it's still relatively recent. And I guess I wonder, is there a, well, you just said, you know, there's a happy ending. Is it over? I mean, or is it something that you deal with in some ways every day?
Well, you know, it's like there's a happy ending, you know, meaning that it kind of ends on the path that I'm at today, but it's not the end.
Right.
So I believe I end the book as basically saying this isn't the end, but this is the beginning, because it's the beginning of a new chapter. It's the beginning of a new life, because I didn't get into a lot of the, like, what I'm doing now. Basically, this is a memoir. This is telling the story. This is telling, like, what it was like in that world and how dark it was and what it took to break free of that. You know, not only, you know, it immerses the person, you know, this starts out right in the thick of the action. And so I think it'll be a lot of fascinating for a lot of people to understand that, to see what that world was like, because nobody's really told that story. There's a few of us that have come out and have written books and told stories, but no one has told the story of it being like, running this organization, what it was like, what the internals were like, what some of the experiences were like. I mean, I went through assassination attempts and all kinds of, like, as you said, there was a lot of violence, especially early on in the book. And you go through those chapters and it was difficult, but you come out the other side, you know, in a more positive light, and you were able to work through that. So processing through that, in the process of writing it, it took a lot, because many run-throughs, you know, you don't just, yeah. I didn't just write the book and it was done. I thought it was, I read through it. I showed some people and they're like, you're not explaining anything about what you felt like, what it was like. You know, you talk about this stuff like it was a day at the office. And I said, well, it kind of was a day at the office back then. Yes, but what were the emotions and stuff? And oh boy, that was hard, because I'm sure I explained to you before, you just didn't show emotions in that world. And to process those things, of course I had them, but those were all stuffed down. So reliving that stuff and processing that, and then getting the book done, and it was like 800 something pages. Publishers and agents, literary agents, were looking at it going, this is too long. Nobody's going to publish this. It's too long. You have to cut it at least in half. So then I need to go back and, you know, tighten things up and get rid of some chapters. And yeah, it was a process. But it was really, really difficult revisiting a lot of those memories, because it's one thing, I think, to like just tell it. You know, I do that all the time with the speaking out that I do. And that's tough too. But when you write it in, you know, when you sit down and write it, that's like there's some sort of permanence in that, I think. And then you overthink everything.
Yeah. I get it. I yeah, you know, another thing that just sort of begs the question is that it was so, the events that you retell, some of them are so wretched, you know. And some of them, you know, they're wretched, not just because it's violent. It's because it's, here you are in a, you know, stinky jail cell or, you know, where, and you're very, you know, you're very explicit about it, which I think is super effective, right? I mean, it's, you know, what it smells like to be in a drunk tank, and I don't know how else to ask it, but what the hell was so attractive about that life? What is it that kept you there? And the other thing is, did you feel like were you doing good? I'm recognizing now that that's not good, but did you feel like you were doing good for your people? Or like, it's just so hard, you know, from somebody who hasn't lived through it, it's so hard to figure out what keeps a guy who, you know, is obviously awake, thinks about stuff, certainly has the wherewithal to, you know, to run this organization. And by the way, you were a music executive of a company, you know, forget the music for a second, because it was frequently about sort of embedded in the movement. But, you know, that takes certain skills. So here's this bright guy who's got a family, or, you know, on the road to, and got a family that he comes from, some of which the negative consequences have fallen on them, even though they weren't in the movement. And it's painful. And some of the stuff you witness is painful in the book. It's painful to you.
Yeah.
What keeps a Jeff Scoop in that world?
You know, in that sense, my story's common to a lot of the other people that become radicalized and become involved in these movements, because you know, there's different reasons why people get in. Sometimes it is trauma, sometimes it is a family connection or a link, or you've been brought up that way. I wasn't. I had a historical family connection, as you know, but there wasn't any propagandizing from my family or anything. This is like a choice that I consciously made. And when you get involved in that, and you know, I explain it the best I can in the book, but it's like, there's a line in there where I say, like, every lash of the proverbial whip, every punishment that I took, or every terrible things that happened to my family because of my involvement, not because of anything they did, those type of things, I internalized them and turned that into more anger. Like, I took it as the system was targeting my family, the enemy was targeting my family, and that just dug me in deeper. It just made me more entrenched. And that is what I mean by a lot of times that sort of thing is typical. But you have this belief system when you're involved in it, like you are, and we've discussed this before, but like that you believe you're doing something noble and good. And that's really one of the big things that holds you into place, is that in your mind, anybody that joins a cult or an extremist organization or anything like that typically believes that they've got it all figured out. You know, that's why they're part of it. We're doing something good. We're going to save our people is my outlook. And, you know, so all of the hardships and things that took place were, I don't know about justified, but it was like, okay, this is, right. I'm willing to suffer for this cause, you know? So a lot of times when people would join over the years, and this, you might find this interesting psychologically, you know, like they would say like, well, what do I get if I join the movement? And that always ticked me off. If they asked me that, or if I heard that from one of the recruiters, I said, you can tell them they get, you know, they get a sacrifice and they get it blood, sweat, and tears. That's basically right. What the, you know, you're not here to get something. You know, you're here to serve the organization. And that was the outlook for most of us.
Sorry about that. Sorry about that.
You're
ring.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that was the mindset.
No. I completely get that. I watched myself in reading it, like, and perhaps it's unfair because I'm watched myself reading it, sort of knowing from our past conversations that there's this whole other guy, right? There's this guy who is not that. And so it was this, what keeps him there? What keeps him there? And it sort of explained, I mean, because one of the questions I had was like, what, for those of us not in that movement, like, what are the, for lack of a better way to put it, what are the core values of the National Socialist Movement, of the Nazi Party? What is it that the organization was striving for? What did they want?
Yeah, so basically the group would, you know, like some of the slogans that they use, like family, race, and nation. So it was like, you know, you're here to serve your family, you're here to serve your race, you're here to serve your country, is how the group would put it out. We know that's not accurate now, but that was the mantra. And basically, you know, the grand goals was to have some sort of white homeland, you know, somewhere where white people were separated and things of that nature. But the underlying cause why people would get involved in it, you know, this hatred that comes, you know, a lot of them would say, and I got some nasty emails and phone calls and stuff like that when I first started speaking out, especially. And they're like, why are you talking about this stuff like it was hate? You didn't hate anybody. You just loved your people. Why are you saying these kind of things? You're lying, you know? And it's like, no, you know, I didn't see it that way as hate when I was involved in it. But when you break it down and you're dehumanizing other people for any kind of reason, that's hateful. And where does that hate come from? And I still don't like the word fear, you know, but a lot of it comes from these underlying currents, undercurrents of fear, you know, and
fear of
being replaced, fear of having their jobs taken away, fear of the unknown really is what it is. And nobody would admit that. I wouldn't have when I was involved either. But if you break it down psychologically, that's what it is, you know. Just like I've explained before, we, you know, the group would show videos and things like that. We'd show people videos of horrible crimes like farm murders in South Africa or racial crimes that happened here in the US. And you would exploit those things and show it to people and be like, look, if you don't get involved and you don't do something, this could be you. This could be your family. So that's what is that? That's if you break that down, that's fear.
Yeah.
Because you know that stuff does happen. That does happen in the world, but
sure.
That there's so much more that's good that's happening and you don't focus on that.
And yet you are able to, that's what that was the other piece about it. Cause I know from our past conversation, you know, we mentioned this before, the process of extracting yourself or the process of being distanced from the movement was gradual. And you could, knowing that, there were all these little instances in your retelling of the story where you could find, you, the reader, could find humanity in this person, in this guy who was leading this hateful organization. Like, I could have the name wrong, but there was you were in jail for a while, Tito? Who was a black dude, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So and it wasn't a hostile relationship.
No, it was good.
So there was this embedded in what, you know, from the outside looking in is a white supremacist organization. There's a relationship, however partial and however circumstantial, with this guy who, you know. Well, if you hold up pictures, who does Jeff hate? And it's like, oh, that guy. Turns out, right. No, not that guy. So there are a bunch of those sprinkled in the stories where it's an indication that this guy, you know, head of this hateful organization is not hateful through and through. And he's not even hateful through and through to everybody. He's
right.
He's able to, he's able to build a bridge and find a bridge and recognize a bridge with somebody who, according to the ideology and the rhetoric, no way.
Right.
No way. And that is the puzzle, you know, the puzzle of how does my friend Jeff Scoop not see, no pun intended, not recognize that there are all these contradictions in his life, even internally, right? It's weird.
Well, and that's, I put that stuff in there. I shared those memories because it was intentional to share that stuff because there was those elements over the years, and it became more common towards the end when I started going through that process. It wasn't for me, and for most people, it's not a snap of a finger's change.
No, right.
I was de-radicalizing, or before I disengaged, actually, which is backwards. You should disengage then de-radicalize. But the last few years I was in, like 2016, 2017, I'm starting to change a lot, but I still didn't leave until March of 2019. Mm-hmm. So, but there is those instances, and there's a lot more that I didn't share in the book, you know, but there's a lot of instances where where I crossed paths with people that should have been the enemy that didn't become the enemy, like the case of in jail and running into Tito. You know, that could have been a very volatile situation. He recognized me and you know, from television, and it was like, oh boy, here we go. This is gonna pop off, and it didn't end up that way. So I think that's not as uncommon in these type of movements as one might think. That kind of thing happens a lot to people, and there's a lot of cognitive dissonance and things that come into play with people, because you'll write off those things. You know, just like when I met Daryl Davis, it was like, well, Daryl's a good guy, but he's still on the other side. You know, you'd still try to, you know, separate that and go, well, he seems like a good guy, but the other ones are bad, right? You know, or right. You met somebody at work that's of another race or something. You go, I get along with them. They're good people, you know, but I'm not going to, you know, you'd have these talks in the movement where people would sometimes say, well, there's this black guy at my work, or this Asian, or this Hispanic, you know, and they're pretty cool. But, you know, and the question would come up, well, what are we going to do when the race war happens? You know, or how, you know, we can't separate. Some people are good and some people are bad. They're just all bad. And you just, that's the way the mindset in that world works. Cause you have to, justifying is not the right word, but for the individual that's doing that, it's justification.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a puzzling thing in some ways, you know, and again, I'm not at the end yet. I haven't reached the end, but it becomes a puzzling thing to how does a human being embrace what is kind of in some ways obviously an ideology that has all of these psychological contradictions, right? They feel all these different, they feel love. They feel love for their people. They feel love. I mean, the movement is steeped in control. It's steeped in hierarchy, right? Those things matter. And yet, you know, you've got bonds that are obviously interpersonal bonds with particular individuals. And those are hard. It's a hard mess to sort through. And I imagine, and I'm looking at it from 30,000 feet. So I imagine it's way harder to be in it and sort those things through, and to do that for 25 years, which is wild. And I did get a sense at reading it. How does somebody stay that long? Well, there's all these terrible things. And at the same time, there are all these things that, you know, you build relationships with the people. So that's there too. You know,
right.
You can't just leave your quote friends. They become almost like family, right? So you can't leave your, what do? Just leave them? How does that work?
Right. Yep. And it is like family too. I mean, that's why I compare it to a cult, because a lot of times for me, my family still stuck by me. You know, I still had that, but a lot of the people don't. They cut their families off, or their families cut them off completely. And, that can be really tough. So it becomes like your family. And, so it becomes very, very difficult. And then you find all these justifications, and I go through some of these processes as well. I wanted to share as much psychologically, so people that read it can understand it. Ones, people like myself that had struggled, whatever it is, whether it's an alcohol addiction, a drug addiction. I had alcohol issues, but I didn't have drug issues. But whatever somebody's struggling with, it could be anything, that this book would uplift them, because they could see, wow, this guy went from the darkness to the light, and these were the struggles you went through. Like, a lot of people wouldn't make it. I'm lucky to be alive, you know, and so it's a cautionary tale. It's also something about, like, look, someone like me could go from that darkness to the light, so can you. But I also wanted to share the the psychological drivers and why somebody stays in place and how that works and how the mindset works. So I feel like I did quite a bit of that in the book. So I feel like it can help people that also that work in, you know, the way people think, you know, sociologists, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, anybody of that nature. Also, it could be helpful for law enforcement. It could be helpful for government, for so many different things. I feel, you know, I don't want to say like it's all encompassing. It can help everybody, you know, but there's so many different, there's so many different nuances in there.
It's not universal love pill. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, again, speaking as an outside observer, I see what you're pointing at. I really do. I see what you're pointing at. And it's almost like there's this gap that this infinitesimally small gap, you explain it. And yet when I really try to dive in, I don't see it. I don't see the how. I'm left with the question, you know, how does this guy who I now feel like, you know, he's my buddy, right? How does this guy who's got all this other good in him, how does this guy after each terrible thing almost hold tighter to the movement, hold tighter to the underlying values of it, and reject or suppress those other things, ultimately unsuccessfully, happily, right? I mean, right. It didn't work, right? It took a long time for it not to work, but it didn't work.
Yeah, it took a really long time, and that's part of the lesson too. Is that, like I said, all those lashes of the whip, like everything that happened, where you would think someone would go, my gosh, look what this is doing to my family. Look what this is doing to my life, my career, everything, everybody around it. It's like a wave. Hate destroys everything in its path. And that was happening. It was just over and over and over, just this wave of disaster and chaos. And you would think like that would be a wake up call that would snap somebody out of it. But it's like all of those things just kept piling up and it just became fuel, like a justification, like, okay, well, if the government's going to try to, you know, is going to mess with my mom's career, they're going to kick my doors in and scare my kids and all this kind of stuff. You know what? I'm going to fight twice as hard. You think you're going to scare me? You think you're going to intimidate me? Guess what? I'm going to come back and I'm going to keep swinging and I'm going to swing even harder. That's basically how that was the story of my life, basically, until I finally, you know, was able to say, maybe that isn't the best tactic, way to approach these things, you know, but it's not even that, you know. In the end, I wasn't scared out of the movement or intimidated out.
No, right.
Those were all reasons to hang on. It was really seeing the humanity in the people that I had dehumanized that really is what clicked that into high gear.
Yeah, that's, maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, but I also want to ask sort of about the internal, in not the function of it, but there's a lot of and maybe it's rooted in fear. I know you don't like the F word, right? You know, maybe it's rooted in fear, but there's a lot of like, I don't know if it's a facade. There's a lot of instances of efforts to show strength, right? To show strength, to show the lack of fear, and it's, you know, I mean, was there that, not just for you personally, but is that a feature of the movement that it's about demonstrating kind of almost steel-like resolve and putting yourself, not you personally yourself, but putting the movement in all of these pretty treacherous situations, you know, being tough, walking into places that, well, you know, walking into places where, like, you know, there are no white faces. And not, so you walk in, not just into a place that there are no white faces, where the only white faces are the skinheads who've walked in.
Yep.
And that's a particular, you know, it's almost like, it seems like that's an effort to show something. And is that, is that what the movement tried or tries to do?
Yeah. I mean, it varies, I think, from group to group, but that was a big part of it in the organization that I was in. I mean, that wasn't a, like a, I don't know if it was a conscious thing like that. I think it was, some of it was subconscious, but showing strength and lack of fear was a huge part of it, you know? So even now, like I said, I still don't like the word fear, even though I can unpack it and that's what it is. I still don't, it's sort of like, no, I'm not afraid of nothing, you know, because I really don't have like that normal fear response that most people do. I don't panic in, chaotic or really dangerous situations, you know, if somebody's shooting at me, I tend to not panic. I'm very calm in those situations, which can save your life, you know, and save my life many times. But yeah, there was one instance I shared in the book where two of us had walked into a all black restaurant in the middle of the night, and I'm wearing a Ku Klux Klan shirt on with the stuff on both sides, and that turned pretty crazy. Yeah,
that was particularly like, wow, what the right.
Stupid. But yeah, well, so
I don't know. I mean, it was crazy in a lot of different ways, but yeah.
It was another one of those things where you're lucky to get out of that alive, you know, and that's just, I mean, there was instances that happened like that. I tell a number of those in the book. That's why some of those chapters move pretty fast, because I needed to cut a lot of things down and removed a lot of ones that were just as volatile or similar. And then there's other memories that pop back later when you're writing, or come back in a conversation. Somebody might say something, you go, oh, wow, huh, I should have shared that too. So, I mean, imagine 27 years of this stuff and some of those memories come back. But yeah, that bravado and showing strength and things like that in crazy situations is done to show strength. And it's also a way of, you know, keeping up the morale of the troops and things like that. I know I had people that had said, you know, hey, we went into a situation where we were outnumbered like 10 to 1. And I was terrified, and I looked at you're not afraid, you don't appear afraid. So then I wasn't afraid. So it came from a leadership mm-hmm. sense, yeah, as well, to inspire the people that are around you, not show fear. Because if you show fear, it was the same way, like if we were having battles, street battles with the communists and Antifa, you know, you go into it, if you showed fear, you're finished, you know. And there was cases in there where, you know, we would charge into them, and I would always look for like the biggest one, or the one that looked like the main fighter, because even if we were going to lose, I was going to try to take down the main person. Obviously, it was self defense, you know, we could never go and attack somebody first, otherwise I would have been in jail a whole bunch of times. So it was I say this with a caveat, but the group I was involved in with street activism and things like that, it was very tight, rigid, and controlled. You couldn't just go out and hit somebody. You had to wait to be hit.
Because of arrest, and you wanted, yes, it to be self-defense.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, believe me, people wanted to go and hit first, but sure, they didn't have... they would be in trouble with the organization if they did, because that put us all at risk.
And how, you know, obviously there's no answer to this, but there's probably an answer somewhere, but what percentage of the people do you think within the organization, were there because they were embraced the same values, and how many just wanted to belong to something that felt strong and good and powerful, and so there it was. But in terms of embracing the goodness, right? You know, for my family, my country, my race. They didn't really give a shit about that.
So, like, that's a tough question. That's a hard one to unpack. I don't know if there's a I can't give a percentage, but I can guess. But that's a tough one because there was people clearly, you know, I mean, you might not see it right away, but some people you would see it. There's some that would just come in that were looking for a sense of belonging, a brotherhood, you know, that sort of thing. They might move on and be with something else. You know, they might join a 1% or bike club or something else where they would find that brotherhood. But it really just depends on the person. Like I was, I'm more of an ideologue, you know, I was into the ideology and things like that. And there was a number of other people that were, but then you had a lot of people in the organization that couldn't tell you hardly anything about the politics of the organization, you know? So they were there for, you know, maybe other reasons, or maybe they like certain aspects of it, but that's a really tough one to unpack because you don't know the psychology of each and every individual. I could think of a lot of different people and both things come into play.
Yeah. And roughly how many, I mean, do you know how many people were in the movement at its peak in your organization?
I never had a real handle on the numbers because it was the movement was a revolving door. There was always people coming and going. The years, it was thousands of people over the years, you know, but at any given time, it's tough to say because we didn't keep very good track of that. People would come and go. People stopped paying membership dues. They wouldn't tell us they were leaving or they just fall off and disappear. So we never really knew.
Well, let me ask you a question. One of the fears about books that are written about cults of one sort or another is that they can sensationalize things, and what is obviously a terrible situation, you know, getting thrown into jail. Right. Or getting thrown into a drunk tank or going into the, you know, to the rib place where I think it was ribs. I don't remember. But, you know, that ultimately is really dangerous, really can be to the wrong person or right person, depending upon how you look at it. Yeah. That's what I want. That's what I'm. Yeah. That's the kind of person I want to be. So did you wrestle with that? Did your publisher, editor, however that worked, you know, say, I don't think you should put this in there because
I thought about that a lot when I first was writing it. And I got to the point where the first run through with the book, because one bit of advice that I had gotten actually from Rabbi Cooper at the Simon Wiesenthal Center, he's like, Jeff, you're overthinking this process. Just tell it like it is. Mm. Be transparent and tell it like it was. And so I did that. And that was the first run of the book. And it was just like, it felt like it was just nonstop violence and struggle. You know, it's like, okay, if this is it for me, if this is the end of the book, I need to throw this in the trash because it's not going to help anybody. It's not useful. So I went back and I rewrote it and expanded upon those things and put some of the emotional toll and some of what was going on to make more sense with it and give more nuance and explain things better and really delve into the psychological aspects. But I struggled with that a lot because I felt like my and I said it to a number of people. I said, if this comes out as any way glorifying that, or that somebody, a young person, might pick it up and be like, oh wow, that's something I want to be a part of. I really don't think it's going to have that effect on anybody because I took extra care not to do that. So I explained, like, look, these things happened and this was the effect that it had, like, on my family, like on everybody around it, and then you know, just some of the other, you know, tragic things that happened to different people that were tied into it or around it. And I don't think that there's much glory to be found in there, really.
Well, I mean, I agree with that. And I, you know, this is why I started there, right? I mean, I started with this question. Is like, I agree with that. And the Jeff Scoop that I know now, the now Jeff Scoop, is like, how the fuck did he stay in that? How could that possibly be? So to the young kid is like, shit, you know. So and I'm not saying you haven't done a good job of it. I just wonder about that piece. I actually think, you know, Rabbi Cooper makes the most sense. It's like, you just have to tell it like it is and be aware that those are the possibilities. And am I putting anything, can I take anything out of here that will make this look less attractive to that? But you never know, you know, things land on an audience the way they land. And you're obviously not writing it to make it feel like an appealing lifestyle.
No, because I did that in the movement. When I was in the movement, I made the movement sound appealing to, that was all of our jobs as recruiters for that movement. Make it sound appealing, make it sound glorious, make it, you know, even if we got beat in a fight or there was a rally and 12 people showed up, we would, you know, say it was a great victory for the cause and for our people. Like that was just standard, like across.
Right.
You could have two guys on a street corner with picket signs and it was a grand victory for the cause. You know, seriously, that's how it was worded. And I don't think, I know that that's not the message in the book. And more towards the end, I go into some of those reflections where basically I probably shouldn't have made it. You know, I was very fortunate, very lucky. So the cautionary aspect of it is like, look, this guy survive this, but the chances of you surviving it are probably not so good. I was very, very fortunate that I made it.
Well, this guy survived it, and yet the toll remains. The toll remains. You know, only you will know the toll on you. But the toll, like, you know, the sad story about, and I know you feel bad about this, but the sad story about your mom, soon to be a judge, and then. No, the governor won't sign the paper because her kid's a Nazi. And I'm like, holy shit, you know.
Right.
So your mom is a saint for not beating the shit out of you.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Yeah. And she was devastated. I mean, destroyed my involvement, destroyed her career. And she didn't talk to me for what felt like forever after that happened. I think it was probably a couple of years, but she didn't really speak to me for a while.
What's your relationship like with your folks now? Well, are they both still around?
My mother passed away just before I left the movement when I was going through that. I do cover that in the book as well. My father's around and he's awesome. He's doing really well and real proud of me and the work that I'm doing and number one fan there.
And would you talk, let's end the conversation like we end the book, you know, so would you talk a little bit about what you're doing now, the work you're doing now?
So the work I'm doing now is basically, you know, I have the nonprofit, 501c3 nonprofit Beyond Barriers, that helps get people out of extremist groups, gangs, cults, all sorts of extremism. I do a lot of, collaborations with the Simon Wiesenthal Center. So with there, I work with the Combat Hate Program, the Museum of Tolerance, Mobile Museum of Tolerance, wherever I'm needed. But I'll go into schools across the country and talk to young people about not getting involved in hate, not getting involved in gangs, and using my story and background as sort of a cautionary tale. Basically educating young people about seeing the humanity in one another and how their choices can lead to really negative consequences. So especially I do a lot of talks in like inner city schools and white supremacy is not an issue when, you know, there's, you know, not any white people in the school or just a handful. So how does my story or my work resonate with gangs? Because a lot of the young people in the schools know or have experienced gang membership or things of that nature. So, you know, I give them things to think about, like how that involvement could affect your family, mm-hmm. how it affected my family, what consequences those can have to help people not get involved in those things. So with the youth, I feel it's super important because, if they don't ever radicalize in the first place, that's ideal. If they're educated, if they understand and see the humanity in one another, then we don't ever have to worry about more Jeff Scoops coming up and getting involved in things like I did and so many other people did. But also, you know, I work with, I speak with adult communities as well, help people with the tools to learn how to talk to one another. I just started a workshop in June. So I've done a lot of talks on relational dialogue, which, you know, is our process where we help get people out of extremist movements and gangs and cults. But how can that process, which works in the extremes, work in regular society? Because we've got this polarization.
I think that's super important. I think that is super important.
It really is.
I really think it's, you know, not even in groups that are polarized or alienated, just the, sadly, schools where young people spend most of their time, you know, relatively few of them spend a lot of time helping young people develop the skills to cultivate compassion, to cultivate connection, to cultivate positive relationship, not because there's a problem, but because it makes life fuller, it makes life better, and it's the antidote, but it's also, you know, it just enriches the world so much more. And schools pay no attention to that. They frequently only pay attention to that if there's a problem. Oh, we have to solve this. And yeah, it's good to solve this. That's great. But way better to give kids the tool. I'm on my soapbox here, but to give kids the tools to cultivate things that, you know, that we don't, you know, we don't spend time teaching them to cultivate. So,
well, right. And in today's society, everybody's on their phones all the time. So they're not having those interpersonal conversations. So that skill set is so crucial. And I was, the one feedback I was getting, from some of the different groups that I spoke with was like, you know, hey, we love hearing about this. We love hearing about relational dialogue, but can you teach it? Can you show us how to do it so we can have actionable items, things that we can take away from? So with the help of Professor Ding-Jo Curry at Leadership Institute in Cal State University, she helped me with the workshop aspect of it because I had never put together a workshop before. So it's like, yeah, I can talk about it all day, but the workshop part, I needed Ding-Jo's help. And so she helped me put that together, and people were ecstatic about it. I can send you a link. You want to check
that,
it out.
That is great. It's so good to hear that, Jeff. Really, mm-hmm. It's so good that you're doing that piece to it. So
thank you.
Well, Jeff Scoop, once again, two things everybody should take a look. I'll make sure this is up on the screen at the beginning and the end for sure. And your website and I'm just so appreciative that you're willing to come and speak about that, and glad you're doing what you're doing now and not what you were doing then. Both for the world and for you.
Right. Thank you so much for having me back on the program. It's been an honor, and you know, keep being curious and doing the great work that you're doing, David.
Okay, man.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.